This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a friend a cup. On the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater, presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5th, 11th, and 12th, 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
KBOO, coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
Somali activist. A local Somali activist earns an apology from Mayor Tom Potter for being racially profiled.
A new peace coalition emerges in the Portland area on Free Speech Radio News.
And on Free Speech Radio News, congressional debate on immigration is heating up.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,297 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded.
IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,235 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 2nd, 2006. I'm LaToya Hudson.
And I'm Eduardo Dillon Tierra.
Portland Public Schools Superintendent Vicki Phillips made it clear at a board meeting last night that she's considering multiple school closures to balance next year's district's budget. Portland schools are an estimated $24 million short for the 2006-2007 academic year. Both the Portland City Council and Portland School Board met yesterday. Their agendas were dominated by the question of what happens to public school funding after the Multnomah County tax expires this year. The tax brought in $90 million this year to school districts countywide. Portland schools got more than half an estimated 200 observers crowded in the City Council budget meeting. The city has $18 million up for grabs, designated as one-time-only funding for an unspecific project. A majority of people who testified before the council meeting advocating giving all that money to the public schools.
Mayor Tom Potter has apologized to a Northeast Portland Somali refugee for being stopped so many times by the Portland police. Potter said the police stops, quote, smacked of racism, unquote. During a city council hearing on Tuesday, Kazi Jama said the Portland police have pulled him over four times in the past 1.5 years. Jama, who fled the Civil War in 1991, has lived in Portland for 7 years and has emerged as a leader in working with refugee resettlement and immigrant communities. Then in 2005, he received a prestigious fellowship, and in 2002, he founded the Center for Intercultural Organizing. Mayor Tom Potter asked the police chief Foxworth to follow up on Jama's concerns. Portland police rules prohibit officers from bias-based policing. Officers can't stop, detain, or search people, according to state statute, quote, when the action is solely motivated by the member's perception of the person's race, color, sex, or national origin, unquote. In 2001, the Portland police started collecting data that showed police were more than twice as likely as to stop African Americans as whites. That was the last time the Bureau released its data, but the Bureau expects to issue a comprehensive report this year on data collected in 2005.
An Oregon National Guard recruiter will be disciplined for placing a misleading recruitment ad on the Portland section of the Craigslist website. KBLU's Jessica Perry has more on the story.
The ad, which has been deleted, read, quote, "Our unit is deployed, so you will not have to serve overseas," end quote. But Colonel Ray Meyer of the Oregon National Guard says there is absolutely no guarantee a recruit won't be deployed. The casualties and growing disapproval of the war in Iraq have led the U.S. military not only to ramp up recruitment, but also to soften its enlistment restrictions. In January, the enlistment age for active-duty Army recruits was raised from 35 to 40. Also, as of last October, high school dropouts can enroll in an Army-sponsored equivalency degree program. More seriously, many fitness requirements, such as weight and body fat limits, have been eased and are not consistent among branches of the military. Potential recruits too out of shape for the Marines may still be welcomed in today's military, as the Army allows some overweight recruits to take its fitness test. Some components of the test include 5 minutes of step exercise. After 1 minute's rest, the recruit's pulse must be under 180. Men must then perform 15 push-ups in 1 minute. Women must do 4. The Oregon National Guard is currently exceeding its recruitment goals by 25%, and many other states' recruitment numbers are up. The Oregon National Guard denies that it is ever dishonest with potential recruits and says the recruiter who placed the Craigslist ad will be disciplined. 2,296 American military personnel have been killed in the war in Iraq as of March 2, 2006, according to a CNN count. 16,742 American soldiers have been injured, and 59 Oregon service members have been killed. I'm Jessica Rink Perry for KBOO News.
University of Oregon students and faculty debated the role of military funding at their school during a forum for the university senate yesterday. The university has 18 active projects and 8 subcontracted projects, funded in part by the Department of Defense. Opponents of the funding say that by taking military money, the university is condoning war. Proponents say the research is not directly for weapons development, and it should be up to the researchers to decide how they are funded. Records for Defense Department funding only go back to 1990. During these years, military funding for university research ranged from $1.4 million to $8.2 million. Biology professor emeritus Frank Stahl said he plans to introduce anti-military funding legislation to the university senate, a body that can approve official advisory resolutions. Math professor Peter Gilkey, though, argued that professors should have the right to choose where they get their funding. Gilkey said freedom of inquiry is an absolute.
An Oregon State University newspaper column called "The Islamic Double Standard" is a source of continued backlash at the Corvallis campus. The Associated Students of OSU and several Muslims and Arab student groups are holding a vigil today protesting the February 8th editorial by student Nathaniel Blake. Blake accused the Muslim world of expecting special treatment in the wake of cartoons published in Denmark depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Blake also suggested that the worldwide riots that ensued in Muslim countries amount to savagery and lead to the expectations that Muslims will behave barbarously. Through the Daily Barometer, editor defended the story. The paper currently is taking pains to check their copy with Muslim students ahead of publication. The PSU Daily Vanguard is also getting heated feedback as a result of a February 21st cartoon depicting an armed Jesus with the heading, "How to Start a Riot, Part 2.
In the so-called terrorism trial of an accused Al-Qaeda operative from Lodi, California, continues. In testimony heard at the trial yesterday in Sacramento, it emerged that the FBI recruited its main informant in the case while he worked at a convenience store in Oregon. The informant, Nassim Khan, testified in court yesterday that he berated Hamid Hayat, who stands accused of terrorism, in a secretly recorded telephone conversation. In the recording, Khan calls Hayat a lazy oaf and a liar for traveling to Pakistan and failing to attend a so-called terrorist training camp in that recording. Hayat responds that the terrorist camps were closed because of the heat. Khan befriended Hayat and other Pakistani nationals in Lodi after the FBI recruited Khan to infiltrate the Pakistani community there in December of 2001.
a federal support program for nuclear workers made sick from radiation contamination could be destroyed by proposed changes, witnesses said at a congressional hearing Wednesday. KBOO's Martha Odom has more.
A House subcommittee was convened on the issue after a memo was leaked from the White House Office of Management and Budget that listed possible changes to the program to limit workers eligible for benefits. The story is reported today in the Richland, Washington, Tri-City Herald. The changes appear to override science to limit spending on benefits, said Representative John Hostetler, a Republican from Indiana and chair of the House Judiciary, Immigration, Border Security, and Claims Subcommittee. The program makes $150,000 payments to workers at Hanford and other nuclear sites if they suffered cancer because of exposure to radiation. Currently, the federal government decides on a case-by-case basis if Hanford workers received enough radiation to cause cancer. In cases where potential radiation exposures are unreliable, workers can petition the federal government to be listed as a special exposure cohort. Workers can then be automatically compensated without having to prove their radiation exposure caused the cancer. The memo called for a White House-led group to look at changes that would make the special exposure cohort designation more difficult to receive. Now petitions are evaluated by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health before the advisory board makes a public recommendation to the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. The memo suggests that the White House should make the final determination rather than health officials. For KBOO News, this is Martha Odom reporting.
In a ruling last week to uphold Measure 37, the state Supreme Court ruled against Oregon's 30-year-old land use laws and paved the way for the kind of urban sprawl that's happening throughout the nation. But lots of questions still remain. KBOO Stephanie Potter has more.
At the annual logging conference held last week in Eugene, Hal Salwasser, dean of the Forestry College at Oregon State University, spoke of how Oregon's 30-year-old land use laws had helped to stave off the conversion of rural lands into urban development.
The country has seen a conversion of forest to residential areas of about 1 million acres per year during the decade of the 1990s. And Oregon has been pretty much exempt from that trend because of our land use laws and our State Forest Practices Act.
But this has changed in the wake of last week's Supreme Court ruling upholding Measure 37 and the right of property owners to either be reimbursed for the value of their land or develop it as they like if regulations enacted after they bought the land reduce its value. Cash-strapped counties are more likely to waive restrictions.
We hope that we don't get on the same trajectory that Washington and California have been on. Each of those states lost about 400,000 acres of forest to residential areas over the last decade.
But under Measure 37, the owner of an 850-acre tree farm has filed a claim with Yamhill County to convert his land into a development of 850 homes. State officials have reported claims for a 4,400-acre subdivision in Baker County and a 1,400-acre proposal in Crook County. According to Bob Stacy of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the claims in the Willamette Valley already total more than 30,000 acres. Salwasser says the prices on development make sales extremely tempting to landholders.
I know of parcels of land in the Corvallis area where I live where a third of an acre is valued at $50,000. So you could take that acre and say it's worth $150,000 as real estate, but it's only worth $50 to $100 an acre as forest land. That's the magnitude of difference in the financial aspects.
Tom Bowerman, a fifth-generation Oregonian and landowner, is on the board of the 1,000 Friends of Oregon. He expects hundreds of thousands of acres to fall out of the land use regulations and added that
millions of acres, actually, in the state of Oregon would be qualified for Measure 37 claims. Almost all of the known 1,800 applications for Measure 37 waivers are on rural lands.
There are questions that remain to be resolved. For instance, whether property owners can bequeath or sell their Measure 37 rights.
The Attorney General's office has given an opinion that they cannot, and the proponents for Measure 37 feel that they can, and this is a question which has not been resolved and probably won't be resolved until somebody actually litigates it and a court rules on that question.
And there are other questions.
For instance, have property owners already enjoyed a form of compensation if they've taken advantage of a farm zoning tax exemption? Or can neighbors claim their own property values or quality of life were hurt by Measure 37 itself? A city manager for Lincoln City was concerned about the possibility of more billboards statewide. So far, 29 lawsuits are now in the lower courts, as reported by the director of the State Land Use Agency. According to Bowerman, federal regulations, such as the Clean Water Act, protected species, or federal scenic regions, are not affected by Measure 37. As to the massive developments, Bowerman remains convinced that voters did not realize that this is what they were voting for.
The thing about Measure 37 is that the proponents of Measure 37, while trying to get it passed, were using campaign messages which depicted grandmothers who weren't able to put a house on their property for their son to care for them in their old age.
Tom Bowerman with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Sal Wasser says that the fate of Oregon's forests may now lie with the legislature.
The body politic of the state needs to give some pretty serious thought to whether they really do want to perpetuate the forest area that the state has been blessed with. About 45% of the land in the state, by the way, is covered by forest, and we've had a very good trajectory of protecting that forest.
Hal Salwasser, Dean of Forestry at Oregon State University, who added that the public might want to consider compensating landowners for the conservation values they provide, for instance, for storing carbon from the atmosphere. He said that this is more prevalent in Asia and Europe, where countries are participating in the Kyoto Protocols. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
The current time is 5:16, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
They say that nobody loves you when you're down and out, but this is ridiculous. Poor Jack Abramoff. Only months ago, this super sleaze lobbyist was the darling of top Republican politicos, delivering bundles of campaign cash to them, including some $200,000 to George W.'s 04 election run. Abramoff took lawmakers on all-expenses-paid jaunts to exotic locales, including squiring Tom DeLay and his entourage to golf outings in Scotland and the Northern Mariana Islands. Jack even had his own posh restaurant on Capitol Hill, where he routinely picked up tabs and held fundraisers for the GOP's power elite. What a guy. But that was yesterday. Today, Republican leaders say, Jack who? In January, Abramoff pleaded guilty to bribery and corruption charges, and he's now singing like a lark to prosecutors, naming politicos involved in his scandals. No Republican loves Jack now. George W., for example, says curtly, I don't know him. Wait a minute, retorts Abramoff. I met with Bush many times. We even talked about family matters together. I was invited to the ranch to visit with him. I was one of his pioneer fundraisers. He doesn't know me? Please. An even deeper cut comes from Tom DeLay, who now coldly asserts, Jack Abramoff and I were not close personal friends. I met with him only occasionally. Say what? Jack explodes. Tom, our family's vacationed together. I've been the go-to guy to sack up cash for your political gambits. And have you forgotten the Northern Marianas, where you declared to a business gathering that I am one of your, quote, closest and dearest friends? This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, Jack, Tom has forgotten you. George, too. It was okay that you were a sleazebag when you could help them, but now you can't, so they've dumped you. The difference between thieves and politicians is that there's honor among thieves. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Africa on Fire. Tonight, Egyptian-American Sarah Rashad visits Portland to present her film about female genital mutilation. We'll get local reaction on that. Plus, international and local African news the corporate media won't divulge. Join host Miriam Fry tonight at 6. Then at 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob, of course. And tonight's weather is going to be cold and rainy through Portland and the Salem areas. And then in Hood River, it's going to be cloudy at 37 degrees. And then tomorrow for Portland and Corvallis, it's going to be more rain, but a little warmer with highs near 55 degrees. And in Hood River, cloudy with highs of 52 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. A new coalition added their voice to the peace movement in Portland this week. People of Faith for Peace brings together leaders from a cross-section of spiritual traditions. Reporter Kirsten Flagg spoke with the group's organizer, RCA Moore, about what it means to be religious and an activist. Moore is a retired Unitarian Universalist minister and a Korean War veteran.
One of the things that I find interesting is, and there are a lot of peace organizations out there, what does an organization of faith leaders have to bring to the peace movement specifically?
Well, I think continuity, that because the people of faith, whatever the faith tradition, begin with the notion that God loves us, every one of us, everywhere, all the time, and that our reaction to that is to love back and also to love the people God loves, everyone, everywhere, all the time. In my life, I was in the Marine Corps when I was a very young man, and I worked in war planning and war analysis work. And I found that, you know, when I became a religious person, you cannot love somebody you're shooting at, and you can't love people that you're planning to kill. The war in Iraq is going to end, let us hope, by the year 2007. When it does, there still will be peace work to do, and God will still call on the believers to do that work.
It's interesting that you mentioned that there will still be peace work to do after the war is over. I think a lot of people think of the peace movement as simply the anti-Iraq war movement. What does peace mean to the people of Faith for Peace?
We are obliged to do peace at every level. That is, your nonviolent behavior in your family and your friends and your neighbors. We're involved, some people are involved in our group are involved in training people to be nonviolent in their everyday lives. When this war is over, we will still have to be talking with our senators and congressmen about not funding this, you know, the Pentagon in the stupid way that we are. Historically, and in the Old Testament particularly, the prophets, you know, stood outside the market and told people, what your king is doing in your name goes, you know, onto your account with God. You'd better get your king under control. And that's certainly true in a democracy.
You're speaking from a Christian background. You were a minister with
Unitarian,
Universalist, Church. But you have people in here that were part of the Lutheran Church, that are priests with the Roman Catholic Church.
That's right.
Rabbi. How are there any challenges to bringing all these different groups of faith together?
Well, every faith tradition, particularly the people of the book, the people from Abraham, the Christians, Jews, and Muslims, but every religious tradition has some very, very clear notions about peace, about our duty to be peacemakers. First and foremost, to be peacemakers. Now, any congregation, you're going to find people of different opinions about what they want to do. If you don't want to be a peacemaker, you can feed the poor. That's something we're supposed to do too. You can help build houses. That's something we're supposed to do too. You don't just have to do peace, but peace is certainly something that we are. If we're not going to do it, we need to do something else that's moral.
One last question for
sure.
You. I know you've been getting a lot of attention for these little green toy soldiers that you're
right.
Handing out. Why don't you tell us about that?
It came to us from two of the women at St. Luke's Church, a Lutheran church out in the Southwest. They came across it somewhere, and we discovered what a great thing. For very little money, you can go down and buy 1,000 soldiers, little toy soldiers in a package. You go to your printer, and you print up little labels with a message. The message I like best is, bring me home. And you put the label onto the soldier, and then people pick them up. I ran into somebody the other day who said, I saw one. It was on a lamppost. And I said, did you pick it up? And he said, no, I thought I'd leave it there and let somebody else see it. The response to the soldiers is just the perfect thing to do about peace. It makes you laugh. It makes you think about what's going on, makes you realize I'm not in favor of this war, and it makes you realize that I need to be doing and thinking positive things about peace rather than negative things about the war. I'll be better off, and we'll all be better off if we do that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moore.
Sure, and bye.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 2nd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on the translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on the translator K220HR. You can log on to the website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is Martha Oldham. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Jessica Perry, Martha Oldham, Kristen Clagg, and Rochelle Saliba. Our engineer is Joshua Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I am Latoya Hudson.
And I am Eduardo Delanderos Tierra. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. They'll discuss the Sensenbrenner Bill and the march to denounce it this Saturday. Then at 9 a.m., it's APA Compass with a focus on the potential impact of the Sensenbrenner Bill on immigrants. Also hear from participants in Disorient, the first Asian American festival of Oregon. Then at 10 a.m., one of the organizers of this year's International Women's Day celebration will tell us what's lined up for Sunday at Portland State University. At 10:30, on Sounds of Awareness, the topic is the psychological challenges of being the parent of a child with disabilities. And at 11 a.m., it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Paz, amor y poesía. Ciao.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, the 2nd of March, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, President Bush urges India and Pakistan to iron out their differences over Kashmir. British courts begin hearing the case of seven people withholding taxes, which they say funds war. And we'll hear from Capitol Hill, where the debate on immigration reform has hit the Senate. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The Senate has virtually assured the reauthorization of the USA Patriot Act. The bill has been locked in Senate debate since mid-December. Democratic Senator Russell Feingold from Wisconsin opposed the measure to the final vote.
The reason I spent so much time in the past few days talking about how the public views the Patriot Act was to make it clear that this fight was not about one senator arguing about the details of the law. This fight was about trying to restore the public's trust in our government.
While some lawmakers agree the bill is not perfect, they say the new version includes sufficient civil liberties guarantees to pass both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The new version will put a four-year limit on controversial provisions and exclude libraries from Patriot Act enforcement. Recipients of national security letters will be able to challenge their cases in court after 1 year. The House is expected to hold a procedural vote next week. President Bush and Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh announced today that their nations have reached an agreement on a landmark nuclear deal. Our correspondent Vinod Kajos reports from New Delhi.
The groundbreaking nuclear deal between the United States and India has passed its second hurdle today. Now President Bush will take the agreement to the U.S. Congress and to the Nuclear Suppliers Group. The deal will require the United States to change a law that prohibits the sharing of nuclear technology with any other country. But today, President Bush was confident that Congress will approve the deal.
Congress has got to understand that it's in our economic interests that India have a civilian nuclear power industry to help take the pressure off of the global demand for energy.
Under the terms of the accord, the United States will share nuclear fuel with India to help power its fast-growing economy, even though India won't be made to sign the International Non-Proliferation Treaty. Bush's visit has been greeted by protests all over India. More than 2 million people have hit the streets in over 1,000 protests throughout the country. Many of these mobilizations were called by India's influential leftist and Muslim organizations. From New Delhi, in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for FSRN.
Ahead of President Bush's visit to Pakistan, an explosion today outside of the U.S. consulate in Karachi killed four, including an American diplomat. Marsoor Hussain has the story.
The explosion took place early Thursday morning in the parking lot of a hotel. A government security expert told FSRN the explosion was carried out by Islamists and was meant to stop Bush from visiting Pakistan. So far, no group has claimed responsibility for today's blast. President Bush told Indian media today that explosions would not deter him from visiting Pakistan. He is expected in Islamabad Friday evening, where the government has declared red alert. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
In Kenya, armed police today staged simultaneous raids on the offices of the Kenya Television Network and the Standard newspaper. Both media outlets are part of the Standard Group, the country's second largest media house. Police reportedly burned thousands of copies of today's edition of the Standard during the pre-dawn raid. Two of the newspaper's editors and a reporter were arrested on Tuesday after the publication of an article about an alleged secret meeting between Kenya's president and a political rival. The journalists have been charged with publishing alarming statements. Kenya's internal security minister, John Michuki, admitted to the government's involvement in today's raids, saying, quote, "When you rattle a snake, you must prepare to be bitten." Argentina's president Néstor Kirchner has urged Uruguay to delay the construction of two controversial paper mills on the Rio-Uruguay border. Residents in Argentina's Entre Ríos province, across the river from the proposed mill site, continue to block roads between the two countries. Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Uruguay today formally rejected a plea by Argentine President Néstor Kirchner to temporarily halt construction of two pulp mills near the common border. In a speech made yesterday to open the legislative year in Congress, Kirchner asked Uruguayan President Tabaré Vázquez for 90 days to allow time for further studies on environmental risks. The planned mills, to be built by Finland's Metsä Botnia and Spain's Ence, have sparked environmental concerns, protests, and a deep diplomatic crisis between the neighbors. Uruguay has dismissed charges that the installations of two major wood pulp plants would pollute Argentina's river coast, a sensitive farming and tourist area. Uruguayan officials have said protest actions blocking travel and trade have negatively affected Uruguay's economy. Argentina has announced the possibility of taking the case to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona from Buenos Aires.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Immigration legislation has finally reached the Senate in what promises to be a highly contentious debate this year. As Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, the range of views on how to implement immigration reform span the ideological spectrum.
In regard to immigration, Congress agrees on one thing. Something needs to be done. But that something is not yet known. Judith Gould is with the Immigration Law Project.
I think the markup showed the wide divergences in ideas about how to respond appropriately.
The markup was held by the Senate Judiciary Committee, where they began discussing an immigration reform package. The starting point is a proposal offered by the chair, Arlen Specter, from Pennsylvania. Senator Specter's bill would increase border security by creating a virtual wall of technology. It would also create a guest worker program in which immigrants can stay for 3 years, after which they would have to return home for 1 year to reapply for the program. Senator Specter's proposal was cordially criticized by senators on both sides of the political spectrum. Lawmakers opposed to immigration referred to the 500,000 immigrants who enter the U.S. unlawfully each year and to the violent reality of the border. They say the way to control immigration is through strict border enforcement. Republican Senator John Kyle from Arizona.
The criminals coming across are between 10 and 15% of those people being apprehended.
And these are bad criminals. These are people accused of rape and homicide, serious drug dealing, and the like. And a lot of these folks are not from Mexico, but other countries, including countries of what we call special interest with respect to terrorism.
This idea parallels legislation passed in the House last year that focuses primarily on border security with human patrols, technology, and a physical barrier. Those whose main focus on reform is border enforcement tend to oppose any sort of guest worker or amnesty program. On the other side of the spectrum are those who defend immigration. They say the economy needs it, and the United States is a country made up of immigrants. They also criticize Senator Spector's legislation. They say his guest worker program that sends people home for 1 year is unrealistic, and that the proposal offers no road to citizenship. Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy from Massachusetts.
I do believe that we should create the opportunities to earn the right to remain in the United States as citizens for qualified immigrants who work, pay taxes, pass criminal and security background checks, and learn English.
Senator Kennedy has legislation that would offer a path to citizenship to a large number of immigrants already in the U.S. Proponents of immigration also say that the U.S. economy needs immigrants, which has led Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California to introduce legislation that would offer residency to all immigrant agricultural workers.
So I had my staff contact every one of the 58 county welfare departments, have them put signs up, tried to recruit workers for ag, and got zero, and have really come to the conclusion that this industry depends on this immigrant labor workforce.
But Republican Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas isn't so sure about what the answer is.
Did amnesty in 1986, we did an enforcement bill in 1996, and now we're at 2006. It seems to be an every decade type issue, and we're at 11 million. So we do amnesty, that doesn't quite work. We do an enforcement bill, that doesn't quite work. And each year, each time, the numbers build. 3 million, 7 million, now at 11 million, illegal or undocumented, however you want to use the term.
Senator Spector is concerned about creating a bill that will be accepted by a majority.
Somebody asked me if we would be able to bridge the differing points of view, and I said I don't think we can bridge all of them. I think we can bridge some of them.
This is the first day of an open process used to create legislation. It is expected to take weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush today urged India and Pakistan to iron out their differences and work towards settling the territorial dispute on Kashmir. Bush's comments were made after he announced a historic nuclear agreement with India, and his comments have already elicited reaction from the region's residents. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan has the story.
George Bush's statement about Kashmir before his arrival to India had already struck a positive chord among many separatists in Kashmir. Prior to his visit to India, Bush said that he had started playing a role in working towards a resolution over claims to Kashmir by India and Pakistan. Many separatist groups in Kashmir are looking forward to an active role by the U.S. President. Yasin Malik is the chairman of Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front, a frontline separatist group in Kashmir.
I hope as a world leader, because he has a very friendly relationship with both India and Pakistan, he will use his good axes so that both the leaders, Prime Minister of India and the President of Pakistan, will be able to resolve this issue in accordance with the wishes and aspirations of Kashmiri people.
Like Malik, many other separatists have reacted positively to Bush's statement. Mohammad Shafi Rishi is the secretary of Democratic Political Movement. DPM submitted a memorandum at the Srinagar office of UN Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan on Wednesday, calling for the attention of visiting U.S. President to the Kashmir issue.
We request Mr. Bush to impress upon the government of India to stop the human rights violations which are prevalent in Kashmir. Because till right from 1989, government of India has murdered more than 100,000 people. Hundreds, thousands of women have been molested and raped. Property worth billions have been destroyed and gutted. These have been done by the government of India through their occupational forces.
Rishi says given the present position of U.S. and Bush in the world, he can press India to give people of Kashmir a right to self-determination. The moderate faction of All Parties Hurriyat Conference also submitted a similar memorandum calling for an end to human rights violations in Kashmir. Many people in Kashmir are also cynical about any positive role by the U.S. for Kashmir issue. Khalid Nazir is an attorney in Srinagar.
A few days back, a statement came from George Bush that any solution which is acceptable to Kashmiris, Indians, as well as Pakistanis, I am trying for that thing. But that's not the possibility. The solution which is acceptable to all of them is not the solution, in fact. The solution should be that which is acceptable to Kashmiris. Because Kashmiris, the people who are really suffering because of the dispute.
And there are others who outrightly reject any role by the United States. Muhammad Hussain teaches at the Amar Singh College in Srinagar.
We cannot expect any solution from the visit of George W. Bush to India, because America in itself is involved in terrorist acts. For example, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, hundreds and thousands of people have been killed and are being killed.
Hussain adds that America's trade interests with India and Pakistan are of more importance to U.S. than a solution of Kashmir issue. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
Authorities in the Philippines said today that threats against President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo's government have eased since she declared a state of emergency to quash an alleged coup plot. However, as Girly Lanao reports from Manila, officials are stressing the need to continue to monitor government opponents, including some media groups.
President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo has vowed to lift the week-old emergency rule as soon as she is convinced that her government was no longer under threat. Today, the heads of the Justice and Defense Departments and the National Police said the situation was normalizing, and if the trend continues, President Arroyo can safely lift the state of emergency soon. Justice Secretary Raul Gonzalez, however, stressed the need for the government to remain vigilant.
As of today, we believe in the Department of Justice that the plotters that sought to undermine and bring down the government have been thwarted. But we need continued vigilance on this. I am satisfied, however, that a significant number of the plotters are now exposed, and the new process of law will deal with them accordingly, as we have, however, to continue monitoring the developments even after the present situation subsides.
Two community newspapers are among the groups Gonzalez wants to remain under monitoring for allegedly publishing negative information and seditious statements about the government. The two newspapers are Panay News and The Daily Informer, both based in the central province of Iloilo. The media has been a primary target under the state of emergency. Just hours after Arroyo's declaration last Friday, the editorial and printing offices of the most critical newspaper against the government were raided. Police were later posted at the door of the Daily Tribune's office in what officials call a physical takeover of the newspaper. Police Chief Director General Arturo Lumibao said the move was aimed at protecting national security. He warned the police will not hesitate to take similar action if other newspapers, television and radio networks also aid or support the government's enemies.
We will continuously evaluate information, disinformation, comments that could contribute to instability. So I said, we appeal to our media outlets to please exercise self-censorship or self-restraint.
In declaring emergency rule, President Arroyo had accused the media of recklessly magnifying her enemies' claims. Her officials denied the government was curtailing press freedom and was instead merely ensuring that no disinformation was being spread. But international and local media groups don't see it that way. They have denounced Arroyo's emergency rule as the worst attack on press freedom in the Philippines since the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos was ousted in February 1986. While journalists have vowed to fight off censorship, the warnings by the police and the raid on the Daily Tribune have raised the risks being faced by the Philippine media. Joe Torres is a spokesman for the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines.
In the past 2 years, journalists in this country have been killed left and right, and most of the alleged perpetrators are either former police officers or active police officers. So with the threat of General Lumiba to raid media organizations and to issue a guideline on how we should practice our profession, we fear that it will have more chilling effects, especially for journalists in the provinces who have been the target of attacks.
The Philippines has been considered as one of the most dangerous places for journalists in the world, after 13 reporters were killed in 2004 and another 10 in 2005. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Lino in Manila.
After years of lobbying and campaigning from human rights organizations, Tony Blair finally told Parliament this week he believes the military detention camp in Guantanamo Bay should be shut down. Meanwhile, his government faces a legal challenge over the use of British taxes for military expenditure. Yesterday, a British court began hearing the case of the so-called Peace Tax 7, seven pacifists who are withholding the 10% of their taxes which fund the Ministry of Defense. Naomi Fowler reports from the Royal Courts of Justice in London.
The seven people in the courtroom today are refusing to pay the 10% proportion of tax which they see as financial conscription to support war. They're asking not for exemption, but for the creation of a special social fund which they can pay into instead.
I'll go to prison if necessary. I just feel so strongly about it.
War tax resister Robin Brooks.
Basically, we don't believe in paying for killing. We would conscientiously object to military service if we were called on, and we feel that paying for that is just as bad.
Another of the Peace Tax 7, Brenda Boughton.
We're now in a situation where the Human Rights Act gives us rights which are then denied by the Finance Act each year to actually argue the contradiction that there now is a legal matter and requires an expert.
And legal experts are banded in this unique day-long court hearing. It's essentially a testing of whether British law complies with the European Convention on Human Rights, which came into force in Britain back in 2000. Article 9 of the Convention guarantees the freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs. If that right is upheld by the courts, the government, and indeed the judges today, are worried about the practical implications. Peace tax protester Robin Brooks believes they shouldn't be.
I don't think we constitute a majority. I mean, I would estimate maybe a quarter of a million people might object. Maybe it would be more. Looking at conscientious objection during the last two wars, it wasn't a significant body of the population. And the problem, of course, in this country is that most people are on PAYE and they're just not able to withhold taxes.
And that's because most people in Britain are taxed at source. The three judges are now considering whether or not they'll grant the request for a separate non-military fund. It's either that, say the peace tax protesters, or eventually it could be prison. This is Naomi Fowler in the Royal Courts of Justice in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Human Rights First has released its first comprehensive report on detainee deaths in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. The report, which provides the first comprehensive account of the U.S. government's handling of cases of detainees who have died in U.S. custody since 2002, documents a lack of accountability and command failure. Danuta Zhafranich reports from New York.
While surveying the death cases in U.S. custody since 2002, Human Rights First did not include deaths that were a result of combat, injuries that arose out of combat, checkpoint deaths, or so-called mercy killings, cases where U.S. custody was questionable. Instead, it took into consideration detainees who were under the custody of the United States at either U.S. facilities or after they had been turned into the control of the U.S. The review showed that 98 people died in custody, of which, using the military's own classifications, 34 were homicides. The organization has identified another 11, suggesting death as a result of physical abuse or harsh conditions of detention. Hina Shamsi, senior counsel at Human Rights First, is the author of the report. In her view, such a situation stems from the fact that top commanders have been unable to translate orders coming from senior army officials in Washington into guidance for troops on the ground.
One of the deaths that we document is the death of Manadel al-Jamadi, and that's the infamous photo, the man inside a body bag with a soldier standing up with his thumb upraised. Part of what's problematic about what our findings were is that it wasn't just confined to Abu Ghraib. Of the 86 deaths that we know to have taken place in Iraq, over 50 took place outside of Abu Ghraib. So it's not just a problem limited to a particular locale, people, or bad acts. It was more widespread than that.
The feedback from Capitol Hill so far has been to call the report hogwash or military propaganda. But there are some who are quite shocked by its findings. Brigadier General David Irvine, a retired Army Reserve Strategic Intelligence Officer from Salt Lake City, taught prisoner interrogation and military law for 18 years. In his view, senior commanders have not been held responsible for their troops, and the U.S. Army has slipped a long way from where it once was, as far as its values regarding treatment of prisoners are concerned.
I think the reason that it happened is that at the highest levels of the United States Army and the Department of Defense, someone made a determination that the traditional methods of prisoner treatment and interrogation were insufficient. And even though the law says that prisoners are to be treated humanely, these officials decided that they could ignore the law and that they could wink. And that's why I say there has been a shocking breakdown of command accountability and discipline. And no one seems to have been held responsible for that except for a very small number of junior enlisted soldiers.
The report contains a number of recommendations that, according to Hina Shamsi, should come from the president as commander-in-chief.
When the president signed the McCain Amendment into law on December 30th, 2005, he left open the possibility, even as he did that signing, that the president or another member of the executive branch could deviate from the ban on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And that kind of lack of clarity is, we think, what led to exactly the kinds of abuses that take place on the ground. So our number one recommendation is that the president make that clear.
Human Rights First also suggests that the Congress should establish an independent bipartisan commission to review the scope of U.S. detention and interrogation operations worldwide. According to the organization, the proposal has already been endorsed by a wide range of people, from Republican and Democratic Congress members to former presidents to leaders in the U.S. military. I'm Danuta Shafranets, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Researchers from the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research have concluded that more than 1 in 3 U.S. soldiers returning from the war in Iraq in 2003 and 2004 requested mental health treatment within a year of deployment. The finding, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, indicates that soldiers in Iraq are more likely to have high rates of post-traumatic stress disorders than those serving in Afghanistan. U.S. soldiers and those documenting the occupation are likely to witness injuries and death, which in turn leads to medical health problems. FSRN's David Enders speaks to a pair of filmmakers about the hazards of working in Iraq.
Fallujah has been closed as a city for 2 months.
Ali Fadl is a 28-year-old Iraqi doctor now studying at New York University on a Fulbright scholarship. Last year, Fadl's documentary City of Ghosts, about Fallujah following the U.S. invasion in November 2004, helped win him the Foreign Press Association's Young Journalist of the Year award.
Terrorism in the Hands of Justice is broadcast 6 days a week at prime time on Al-Iraqi TV. The station was set up with American money and is supposed to be independent from the government.
Fadl also made a short film about Terrorists in the Hands of Justice, a program on the government-owned Al-Iraqiya station for which the Ministry of Interior provides videotaped confessions from alleged criminals and insurgents. Fadl's film offers a unique look at the way in which video is being used by all sides to intimidate and terrorize.
It's very, very difficult to work with the Iraqi forces and the Iraqi government. They think that of you being a reporter and you're not from the Iraqi or not from the chance that belongs to their parties, it means you're against them. Sometimes filming in the street is difficult.
In some places, filming is simply impossible. Cities in western Iraq are under full guerrilla control. Last year, an Iraqi colleague of Fadl's managed to spend 3 days in the city of Haditha in western Iraq. Haditha is under militant control, and the only people allowed to film are the men who produce videos of public beheadings that are available in the market.
The insurgents in Haditha and these places, they're very well organized. They have their own people sitting on the entrances of the city. They watch every car that comes in. If anyone is a stranger inside it, they will follow that car, and this is what happened. In these places, Haditha and Dana, it's not being a journalist working for Western media. This means nothing for them. Those are extreme Islamists. they are Salafis. For them, a journalist, even if you are Iraqi, even if you are from their own homeland, you have to be killed, because journalism as its own, in their religion, in their way of religion, is banned. It's not allowed. It's haram.
The problems with working in such a manner drove American filmmaker James Longley to northern Iraq to finish his documentary, Iraq in Fragments, which won accolades at the Sundance Film Festival. Longley spent 2 years in Iraq and filmed more than 300 hours of footage. But even before things became too dangerous, Longley said he rarely saw other journalists while working in Nasiriyah in south-central Iraq.
It wasn't the most obvious place to go, right? I mean, it's kind of in the middle of, I mean, it's not Basra, it's not Najaf. It's also one of the more politically active and the more politically diverse places in the south. And so it was an interesting place to work. And, I mean, but like I say, there weren't that many other journalists that I saw around at that time. In, like, spring of 2004.
Longley says that in some cases he has been surprised by the response.
You know, I mean, my film is different in that it's basically not about U.S. soldiers at all. There are almost no soldiers in it, no speaking parts for U.S. soldiers.
Iraq in Fragments is being shown in the next few months around the country. Ali Fadl's writing and short films are available at www.guardian.co.uk. In New York, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Pogado.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 2nd of March. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Indian housing leaders are speaking out against President Bush's budget elimination of a training and technical assistance program run by the National American Indian Housing Council. At a press conference in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, 9 tribal leaders from regions across the country asked why the 32-year-old program is on the chopping block when it provides free training to the most underhoused population in the country. NAIHC currently offers 45 different training programs, while the Department of Housing and Urban Development only offers 6. NAIHC's Chairman Chester Carl says Congress should be proud of its investment in the program, and through training, assistance, research, and other means, NAIHC has helped to provide over 6,000 housing units in Indian Country last fiscal year. Executive Director Gary Gordon says there is an immediate need for 200,000 homes in Indian Country, but he says the work the organization does addresses more than just the physical needs.
Now, NAIC also looks beyond just the bricks and mortar aspect of housing into other areas that tribal housing authorities have to deal with, like the scourge of methamphetamine, which is becoming far too prevalent in Indian housing. You know, the meth detention and management of housing is extremely hazardous and dangerous and complicated. And, you know, we're pleased to be able to work with the tribes to provide them as much assistance in that area as we can.
There has been a request from tribal leaders for more training courses about methamphetamine on reservations over the past year. Beyond training, NAIHC estimates that at least $1.1 billion per year in funding is needed for the Native American Housing Block Grant. Bush's budget request falls $120 million below that estimated need. In other news, 4 tribes recognized by the state of Louisiana have been trying for over a decade to also get federal recognition. Now, as they rebuild after being hit by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, they formed a coalition to work on recovery efforts. And as Andrew Stelzer reports, that budding partnership may have benefits if and when federal recognition finally comes.
Up until this point in time, we had no desire to make a stink as far as state or federal recognition.
Randy Verdon is the chief of the Bayou LaForche Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha Confederation of Muscogees, also known as the BCCM.
But because our existence depends on it. You know, we have to make a stand, and we have to be heard, and we have to be recognized, or those things are going to be lost, and lost forever.
As part of their latest application for federal recognition, 3 tribes of the BCCM adopted a resolution that they won't pursue land claims or casinos if they're granted federal recognition.
Because to people in the area and to politicians at the state level, it was convenient for them to make those claims and deny us 2 times before being granted state recognition on the third try.
Howard Nakin, chief of the Isle de Charles Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha, says he doesn't think casinos would be the answer.
We don't have a land big enough to put a casino. If we go that way, there's some big money people that's going to come and do it. So who's going to run the casino? So who's going to make the money? Not the Indians. It's going to be them. So, I mean, you know, that's why we ain't got no interest in it.
Marlene Foray, chief of the Grand Kailau Dulac Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha, says there are plenty of opportunities for the tribes to use federal assistance to become economically sustainable or profitable.
The Indian population would gain more by opening up businesses and helping the communities to rebuild.
The Point Ushien tribe is working with the BCCM on hurricane recovery issues, but they are seeking land rights. Chucky Verdin, chairman of the Point Ushien, says tourism or fishing enterprises would be the most obvious business the tribes could set up with funds they'd be entitled to if they were recognized.
Just to have a land back so people could go back and fish there. And if they happen to find some more oil, you know, it'll come to us instead of to the oil field company or whoever.
The tribes are hoping to hear back on applications for recognition by the end of this year or early 2007. From Point Ushien, Louisiana, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C. Defending Native American interests since 1976. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
On APA Compass, we will focus on the Sensenbrenner Bill and how this anti-immigrant legislation will affect APA communities. Also, we will talk to the filmmakers and volunteers who made Disorient, the first Asian American Film Festival of Oregon, such a huge success. Tune in at 9 a.m. on Friday, March 3rd for APA Compass.